little son. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray.
So welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Everybody knows that song. We are back here. It's Nick DiGilio. And yeah, that is obviously Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel, featured in the film, one of many Simon and Garfunkel songs featured in the classic film, The Graduate. And my guest right now is Beverly Gray, who is the author of a terrific book about the making of The Graduate and its impact and everything The Graduate related. It's called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How The Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. Beverly Gray is an author, and she's been in the movie business for a while, a long time. You can check out beverlygray.com for more information. We have a link on our Facebook page as well. It is hard to believe that the film recently turned 50 years old, if you can believe that. And celebrating that milestone is this really terrific book, Seduced by Mrs. Robinson. And let's welcome Beverly Gray back to the show. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
It's nice to talk to you again, Nick.
Yeah, it's been a while. I can't believe how, you know, it's been a few years since you've been on. Last time you were on, we were talking about your terrific book about your years working with Roger Corman.
That's right. And this is a little different kind of film.
Yes.
This is a huge, huge moneymaker, but also a film that was, like Roger Corman movies, a youth movie, really. The youth of America took this film to their hearts.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. Let's talk about this. Reintroduce yourself to everybody. You've been in the business for a while, and then you worked with Roger Corman, and you have a blog. Tell everybody how you got started in the business.
All right. Well, that's an interesting story, because I didn't expect to be in the film business. I was one of these arty kids. I went to college as an English major. I was interested in theater. And while I was in grad school working on my PhD in English, I said, you know, it would be kind of fun to be writing, not just for my professors, that's all very enjoyable, but it would be fun to be writing for everyday folks as well. So I walked into the campus office of the UCLA Daily Bruin and said, I would like to write about theater. And the guy who was the editor there was kind of a theater snob, and he looked me up and down and said, well, you can go to the movies. So that's how I started going to the movies and writing about movies. And then, lo and behold, one day a professor of mine called me up and said, there's this man named Roger Corman who called me, and he's looking for an assistant. So, of course, my first question was, well, who's Roger Corman? Because I didn't know. I wasn't that kind of kid.
Yeah.
So I had to start out looking at biker movies and horror flicks and monster movies.
Now, let me ask you a question. You didn't know who Roger was. We've talked about this the last time you were on. You didn't know who he was, but
no.
What was your impression when you saw some of the movies he was responsible for?
Ooh, this will be interesting. The funny thing is, I actually had two job offers the same week, which doesn't happen very often. And one was teaching high school English in kind of a spiffy girls' school, a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And one was working for Roger Corman. And I went to my professors and said, you know what I really want is to be a professor of literature. What do I do? Which of these two jobs is going to make more sense for me? And they said, oh, go with the movie job. So I think it was a little bit of envy on their parts.
Yeah.
That's where I ended up and discovered there was a whole other side to me, perhaps, than I knew anything about. So I had a great deal of fun making cheapy monster movies.
Right. And your book, Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers, is a remarkably entertaining piece of work, Beverly.
Thank you.
Talks about the time that you worked with him and all that stuff. So it's a really terrific, book. And you keep up with movie reviews and things like that, correct?
That's right. What I do is, partly for my own pleasure and partly because there are people out there who want to read what I have to say, I write a blog called Beverly in Movie Land, and I'm very faithful. I put it out twice a week, usually Tuesdays and Fridays, and I write about movies, movie making, and growing up Hollywood adjacent. So right now, for instance, I'm writing about the Golden Globes
sure.
and the movie The Phantom Thread, which have some interesting connections in terms of the role of clothing and fashion. But on another day, I might be telling Roger Corman stories.
Yeah.
So anything that occurs to me that's movie-related, I feel is fodder for my blog, and I have a lot of fun with it.
That's great. Well, you mentioned Phantom Thread. Wow, what a remarkable piece of work that is.
It is. It is. I saw it just the other night, and
yeah.
despite a bad cold, I was absolutely mesmerized by it.
Yeah.
So that'll be up tomorrow.
Good. We'll have to look forward to reading that. What were your impressions of the Golden Globes, Beverly?
Well, let me talk about it from the point of view of the Phantom Thread, which is kind of fun. Is that clothing were obviously being used to make a statement in an interesting way.
Right.
Which I thought was very dramatic and effective. I thought it was aesthetically effective. There was just one little corner of my brain that said, if women are worried about men's harassment, some of those outfits are pretty look at me and maybe not in the best way. Perhaps there's kind of a mixed message going on here. So that was one of the things that occurred to me
mm-hmm.
and that I write about in the blog.
Mm-hmm. All right, interesting. So how did this book come to you? What had you always been a fan of The Graduate? Was it something that you were interested in?
Yes, I always was a fan of the film, and let me take you back to that era. And it was, I shudder to mention it, because everyone will know how old I am, but what can I do? It was 50 years ago when The Graduate came out,
right.
in December 1967, and that was a very important era for me. Obviously, when a young person is about to leave college, it's an important era. But I think that particular era for a very large group of baby boomers was a difficult time. Tempering our excitement about going into the world was a real sense of dread about where our country was going. And there were a lot of reasons for that. Those of us like me remembered very well the assassination of President Kennedy. We were in high school. We remembered how idealistic a lot of us had felt about the civil rights movement, and maybe some of us had marched and held candles and sang We Shall Overcome. And yet what was happening by the summer of 1967 was some really brutal clashes in the streets, with people being killed and stores being burned down and so on. And then worst and worst of all, of course, was the Vietnam War, which had been creeping up on us. The movie The Post is very interesting about that. But it had been creeping up on us. But by 1967, we were really starting to realize this was our war, and we had to have some feelings about it. And in the summer, I had to look up the dates because I wasn't sure when this happened, but it happened in the summer of 1967, exactly when The Graduate was being shot. President Lyndon Johnson signed a revised Selective Service Act, which said that no more could most bright young people happily go from 4 years of undergraduate college into grad school. That after 4 years, and it couldn't be more than 4 years, unless you had some very particular kind of excuse, you were draft fodder.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that makes that so interesting is The Graduate is not about that. The Graduate doesn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Benjamin Braddock is floating around in the swimming pool. He's out of college. He's not going to go to grad school. He's not doing anything. And nobody says, oh, my God, you're going to get drafted, because that was really a different story from the one they'd always been planning to tell. And it was an unfolding story. But the people who saw the movie identified with this young man and his confusion and his sense of not knowing where he was going. And they, I think the movie always would have been successful because it's a great, great movie. But in that particular moment in time, it was like a whirlwind.
Yeah.
They just flocked to it.
And it's
they saw it again and again.
What's interesting about it, Beverly, is that, you know, the book, as you talk about in your book, the book was written in 1963.
Right, and published in 1963, written before that. Yeah.
And you know, Mike Nichols, as the director, sort of wanted it to take place at that time, which is why you know, a lot of the political things that were happening, a lot of the turmoil and upheaval, isn't in the movie, because the movie takes place, you know, in the book takes place 4 years prior.
Right. Well, they weren't thinking about the era at all. I mean, they were setting it in sort of the vague present.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really pinned to any particular point in time. And Mike Nichols, and I find this fascinating, later after he took the film around to college campuses, which he was being paid to do as a way of promoting it, was kind of shocked that people kept saying, and some of the more angry and ferocious people, young people, kept saying, well, where's Vietnam? Why aren't you writing about Vietnam? Where is that?
Yeah.
And he was sort of insulted and said, boy, you know, you couldn't be a serious person unless you talked about Vietnam. He said that was the fad of that era, the faction.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me because Vietnam wasn't for us in that time a faction. It was life or death. And so we can certainly be forgiven for fixating on it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the origin of it. This book written by this young guy, 24 years old.
Right.
And it catches people's attention. And I love you write, you know, I mean, you write from the, you know, the book is about everything. I mean, from the beginning of the writing of the book through the incredible deal that was made to get the movie made, and through, you know, what avenues it took and finding Mike Nichols and all of that stuff coming together. But let's talk about the book itself, the sure. origins of the book.
Sure. Well, there was an interesting young man named Charles Webb. He had grown up in Southern California in the Pasadena area, which your listeners might not know, was always, by Southern California standards, considered kind of a ritzy backwater, you know, sort of the nicer houses and the better people. So that's where he grew up. His father was a doctor, and he went to a series of fancy prep schools and boarding schools, and then he went to Williams College on the East Coast. And when he came back from Williams College, apparently, not quite knowing what to do with himself, he saw a bridge game going on in his parents' living room, and there was this very attractive older woman, and that sparked something.
Yeah.
A lot of somethings. And he went off to the library and started writing because, of course, he had aspired to write. So that was the origin of Mrs. Robinson. She's not a real person, except in that glimpse that he got of her.
Mm-hmm.
But he had his own romantic complications, which he put in there, and a lot of other stuff. And it's an odd book because some of it is very good and very effective, and some of it is not. He's a talent, but not a great talent. So that was the book. And it was published. It was not particularly in any way, shape, or form successful, but it did get a review, a fairly respectful review in the New York Times, in which, not a major review, but, you know, it was featured in a column with some other stuff.
Yeah.
And the reviewer said that there are some really interesting things here, and he mentioned two of those things that have become legendarily part of the film. Benjamin in his scuba gear at the bottom of his parents' swimming pool.
Yeah.
And again, Benjamin on that bus at the end with the bride in full regalia.
Right.
So he thought those things were pretty great, but he said, I don't understand these characters, and I don't think that the author really understands them either. But maybe someday, it's possible, there's enough here, that someday this character may be talked about enough so that he will be on the level of a Holden Caulfield.
Right.
Something like that. So
right.
he made a kind of a link to that sort of strange offbeat rebel, that rebellion that's in Catcher in the Rye. And that certainly caught the attention of a young producer named Larry Turmond, who
right.
had a little bit of experience, but wanted to go out on his own and had always, of course, like everybody in Hollywood then and now, wanted to make The Catcher in the Rye.
Right. Well, hang on, Beverly, hold on. We have to take a break, okay?
Okay.
All right, hang on a second. Beverly Gray is with us, and she is the author of a terrific book about The Graduate called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson. It's available now. BeverlyGray.com is her website if you want to check out her blog as well. When we'll come back, we'll talk more about the making of The Graduate and its impact and just this really terrifically entertaining book that Beverly Gray has written. That's all coming up.
Darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. That, of course, is Sound of Silence from the great movie The Graduate, which is the movie that has been written about by Beverly Gray in a terrific book called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson. And Beverly Gray is with us, beverlygray.com, G-R-A-Y, is the website. We have a link on our Facebook page. And let's get back to the conversation with Beverly. Beverly, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm still happy to be here.
Oh, no, I'm happy to have you. So the Terman gets involved.
Right.
And then through, I don't want to get into all of it because there are other things I want to touch on.
Sure.
Joseph E. Levine gets involved and they get Mike Nichols, who had directed a bunch of stuff, who had, you know, had a comedy career here in Chicago. We all know Mike Nichols, obviously.
Oh, right. University of Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. And he and Elaine May, you know, got their career started here. And then he went on to direct. And he was directing, I guess, Barefoot in the Park at the time when they kind of approached him. And then it got the ball rolling. Now, let's talk a little bit about, because the unusual casting of Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Because what do people picture him to look like in the book?
Well, first of all, just to clarify, the book is not the kind of book that describes anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know exactly what he looks like. But when you read about that character, who's supposed to be a very successful recent college graduate who was a student body officer and led the, you know, the yearbook and the track team, etc., you do tend to picture somebody kind of tall, muscular, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the obvious, looking around, the obvious person you might think of is someone like a Robert Redford. And that was a very reasonable guess. In fact, Mike Nichols at first, and I have this from Larry Terman, really was quite happy to have Robert Redford, who had starred for him in Barefoot in the Park,
right,
as a young husband, amiable, smart, but funny. I mean, he was a capable actor, a good guy. They, you know, why not? And there's a famous story, and I don't think it's exactly true, but it's a really good story,
mm-hmm,
about why Mike Nichols decided against that. He did have Robert Redford as one of the six people to whom he had narrowed it down after a lot of searching. And then apparently Redford said, well, why don't you just give me the part already? And Nichols said, well, I don't know. What was the last time you ever struck out with a girl?
Hmm.
And Redford said, what do you mean? And just that idea of Redford as someone who exuded confidence and sexual power just seemed not nearly as funny as casting someone who seemed a little bit more woebegone.
Yeah, yeah.
So people have argued that Dustin Hoffman doesn't come off as the guy who achieved all those athletic and honors, but he's definitely the guy that America fell in love with, or young America fell in love with. But one thing I'd like to make one point, which is that Dustin Hoffman at first thought that he was all wrong for the part, and even apparently said to Mike Nichols, you know, it's just not me. I mean, this is Benjamin Braddock. This has got to be a Mayflower kind of guy. You know, it's not me. And Nichols apparently said, I know what you mean, but maybe he's Jewish inside. And this is something that says a lot about Mike Nichols and
right,
makes the whole subject very interesting, because Mike Nichols, despite the kind of Anglo name, and was a someone who had fled the Holocaust at age 7,
mm-hmm,
and had come to the country as a refugee, as a very small boy. So he had been through a lot, and his sense of the darkness of the world and his sense of being an outsider in a world where he never would completely 100% feel at home, that was in him, and he put some of that into The Graduate.
Yeah.
And it seemed to work for all those young people who, for whatever reason, felt that they were not part of the mainstream and that they were outsiders. And they saw that in Dustin Hoffman, but Hollywood at first did not. So that when the film, the finished film, was screened for, you know, industry screenings. People were coming up to Larry Turman and to Mike Nicholson saying, gee, great film, too bad you miscast the lead. Mm-hmm. And they were convinced that this was a disastrous mistake. However, the youth in America told them differently.
Yeah. And how did Simon and Garfunkel become involved?
They were, of course, very popular at the time.
Yeah.
And Mike Nichols was sent by his younger brother one of their albums, probably Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. And they would. He found himself playing that album a lot as he got ready for the set every day. And it occurred to him that the kind of singing that they did, that kind of sense of loss and melancholy and sweetness, but a little bit of confusion, that really fit this movie. That this movie didn't need a kind of a rollicking score. He wanted the melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie has a lot of passages, one very important passage in the middle, which is basically all music and scenes, interlocking scenes cut to music, and this music, like Sound of Silence, was being used. It was originally supposed to be temporary. They were supposed to write something else. Simon, who was the writer of the two, was commissioned to write three songs. Never quite got that done. He wrote one. Nobody liked it. But he was fiddling around with something called Here's to You, Mrs. Roosevelt, and it didn't go much further than that. And they said, ah. So that, of course, transformed into Mrs. Robinson, and a little snatch, but it's very small, a little snatch of that's in the movie.
Yeah.
But the film's, the main music, the way I see it, is Sound of Silence, and then Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. And when those were put into the film and it was decided they would stay there, that they were no longer placeholders, that this was it, the financier, Joseph E. Levine, was kind of shocked and said, you can't do that. You can't do that. Everyone will laugh at you if you use the same music that everybody already knows, because this music is very popular.
Yeah.
You know, bad idea. And they said, well, why can't we do it? And they did.
And it's amazing. The thing about, there's so much more that we could talk about, but we're out of time, Beverly. The book is just tremendously entertaining and really informative, and it's a touchstone film that to this day still affects people. It is a timeless, it is a truly timeless movie, although, you know, maybe the fashions and stuff are a little bit dated, but its themes are timeless, and you capture all of that and its impact in the book. And there are so many good stories in it about the making of, and you got so many great interviews. It's a terrific book, Beverly.
I do appreciate that. And one thing I just want to add really quickly is that obviously it means a lot to my generation, but a lot of young people we'll see in this film things that they identify with it, too. It's that kind of movie.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff is there.
Yeah, no question about it. No question about it. It's a great book. Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. Beverly Gray, just a delight having you on. We have to do it a little bit sooner than the last time, okay?
Well, it sounds good. We could talk Oscars.
Oh, yeah. Let's think about that. Yeah, the Oscars are coming up at the beginning of March. We can do that for sure.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Okay, Beverly, thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Pleasure.
Beverly Gray, she's great. BeverlyGray.com is the website. She writes a blog. She's been in the business for a long time. I mean, for God's sake, for years, she worked for Roger Corman. And her new book is Seduced by Mrs. Robinson. It's all about The Graduate, and it is a terrific book about a classic movie. So, all right, we'll take a quick break. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're going to talk about great actors and actresses who are consistently great, like good in everything, like, you know, great actors and actresses inspired by this piece about Denzel Washington. All right, we'll take a break. It's Nick DiGilio. News is next.